Hey, you. You feeling good? You working hard? Yeah, it shows. Lots of productivity out there. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, the 2nd of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We had best begin today, I think, with a definition. Worker productivity is the metric of the day, and in very basic terms, it is the number of widgets produced per hour worked. I mention it because we learned this morning that in the first quarter of the year, productivity rose at the fastest pace since 2014. Inserts a caveat here about quarterly numbers bouncing around a lot, but generally speaking, we are seeing increased productivity. Now, that is weird because more productivity usually leads to higher wages, which really isn't happening at the rate you'd think. And sometimes it can lead to inflation, which is definitely not happening. So, what gives? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson hopped into a metaphorical boat to explain.
Breaking records and taking names.
Picture a crew team.
In 3, 2, and 1, jump and send, go.
8 rowers or workers and a manager, the coxswain, calling each stroke.
Now, settle.
Aparna Matter is an economist at the American Enterprise Institute. She says if you want the boat to go faster, the owner could maybe get those rowers some better oars or a faster boat.
It's the same number of people in a boat, but having access to better tools just makes the boat go that much faster.
Or maybe the owner could figure out some way to improve results, row faster, without a big investment. Dean Baker is at the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
In a tight labor market, employers have incentive to try to economize on labor. They have an incentive to figure out, can they reorganize their workplace to be more efficient?
Baker says if companies can produce more with the same workers, they don't have to compete to hire new workers in a tight labor market, which often means paying more. And those companies can absorb the modest wage increases we have been seeing without raising prices, which may help explain why inflation is so low. Ken Kuttner is an economist at Williams College.
We tend to think of inflation as happening when people are trying to buy more stuff than is being produced.
If you get a raise and you have extra money to spend, that increased demand for goods can push prices up. But if you want to buy more stuff at the same time that the economy is making more stuff,
I think it's the balance between those two that is preventing inflation from rising.
But if wage gains started to really outpace productivity growth, that's when you start to worry more about inflation. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We're going to take a quick turn to the price of money in this economy right now. I told you yesterday the Federal Reserve is going to keep interest rates right where they are, relatively low, thus money stays cheap. In the private sector, though, it's not quite so simple. Companies that want or need to borrow money got to pay what the market demands. And the riskier the company, the steeper the price or the interest rate that that company is going to have to pay. Enter now Tesla. The electric car company just announced a big plan to raise a whole bunch of cash, a bit more than $2 billion. Some of that new stock, the rest in bonds. Tesla has been issuing bonds, that is borrowing money, for years. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, the more that company borrows, the more interest it's got to pay.
Tesla's got a lot of big plans. A huge battery factory in Shanghai, a cheaper electric car it's trying to mass produce. CEO Elon Musk says the company could even develop its own leaf blower. But as of last quarter, Tesla's also not a profitable company right now.
And even though they've had profitable quarters, that ultimately is a huge cash burn.
That's Daniel Ives at Wedbush Securities. He says, yeah, selling bonds to raise cash, it's about time. Especially when the company just said its cash pile dropped by 40% last quarter.
The fear was if this continued to go on the next few quarters, the cost of capital would even increase for Tesla.
Its cost of borrowing is already high. Some of its bonds pay north of 8%, rates that rival government yields in risky countries like Turkey and Ukraine. Matteo Arena at Marquette University says adding more and more debt comes with risks.
Every $1 billion in debt they add, they get one inch closer to default and possibly bankruptcy.
That's if things go poorly, if Tesla's cars don't sell or a recession hits. Evan Raleigh at the University of Minnesota's Carlson School of Management says borrowing more could also help the company become profitable again.
Tesla really needs the money to produce the cars that they are trying to sell.
Tesla says it expects to become profitable by the third quarter of this year, and that its fundraising should give it enough cash for at least the next 12 months. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Quick follow-up now to our occasional coverage of President Trump's choices to join the Federal Reserve Board. Herman Cain, we told you about last week, he withdrew. Stephen Moore got the Twitter treatment this morning. The president announced in a pair of tweets that Moore has withdrawn from consideration as well in the face of sizable opposition from Republicans in the Senate. On Wall Street today, I don't know, maybe a little Fed hangover? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Corporate America is very slowly but somewhat surely getting more diverse. More people of color in executive and management ranks, more women too. Not so much, though, at the board level. Women are being named corporate boards of directors, but overall diversity in boardrooms isn't changing all that much. Vanessa Fermans wrote about it in the Wall Street Journal the other day. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Give us a sense, would you, of the gender breakdown on broadly speaking, corporate boards today?
Well, it's about 20-something percent. Well, just under 20% women, actually. The rest are men. That breakdown is changing, but it's changing very slowly.
Which is why we got you on the phone. What is going on in corporate boards across this economy that change, that gender breakdown change, is happening so slowly?
Well, two things are happening. One is there is a lot of pressure and growing pressure on companies to appoint more women to boards than ever. And you are seeing a lot of recruiting going on. But the overall numbers aren't changing very quickly for one big reason, and that is there's just very little turnover. Once somebody gets on a board seat, they tend not to leave for a very long time.
Which is to say, mostly men, and I'm going to guess here probably mostly white men, get on boards and stay, right?
Yes, there's even a catchphrase for it, male, pale, and stale.
well, there you go. All right, so I have some questions. First of all, how long are these men staying? What's the average tenure?
The average is over 10 years, just wow. Over, and for at least 25% of them, over 15 years.
Are board members well paid, generally speaking? Well compensated?
They're well paid. Yeah. They're well paid. It ranges from a few hundred thousand to several hundred thousand, I would say, a year to maintain right. One of these board seats.
Right. And is it just that these folks who get on the boards, they like it and they want to stay and nobody's pushing them off?
I think so, for the most part. For a lot of people, I mean, a lot of older people, and again, we're talking about predominantly men, it is a phase of semi-retirement where right. They are still actively involved in advising a company, but not in the day-to-day operations. And for many of these people who played very active lives in their professional careers, it's a very happy medium, which is probably why a lot of them want to stay where they are.
You write about some large institutional investors and shareholder groups trying to get companies to impose, in essence, term limits. How's that going?
Not so well. You see sort of momentum around this every several years, big shareholders talking about it. But both shareholders and companies are leery of imposing too strict or too blunt of an approach to this. They worry that if they say, okay, 8 years and you're out or what have you, they're going to kick a lot of knowledgeable people off of boards. It can be very disruptive to boards.
Hmm. So is this one of those where, and this is, I can't believe this would be the response, but is it just, it's going to take time?
I think so. I mean, there simply is not a hard and fast rule around this. Companies have also tinkered with age limits.
Yeah.
For a while, you saw companies actually increasing the age, the retirement age for boards. You know, the idea that 70 is the new 50 or the new 60.
Right.
Now, with this pressure to increase turnover, bring new and more diverse experiences onto boards, that's starting to change.
Vanessa Fermans, a reporter and editor at The Wall Street Journal. Vanessa, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
There was a report out from Moody's the other day. They're the bond rating people, but they do all kinds of financial analysis as well. They were talking about companies buying back their own stock, specifically how much stock buying back is happening and how much longer it might go on and why it matters. The answer to that first question is that a lot of buying back is happening. Last year, stock buybacks by the American companies that had the most cash on hand went from $71 billion January through June to $114 billion in the second half of the year. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has the answers to the other two questions.
Last year, companies got a big tax cut, and they had to figure out what to do with all that extra cash.
They could pay their workers more. They could pay out dividends. They could invest in the firm if they had good investment projects to do, or they could do stock buybacks.
Mark Mazur at the Tax Policy Center says a lot of companies chose option four, stock buybacks, which hit a record $1 trillion at the end of 2018. One interesting thing in the Moody's report is that even though the tax law went into effect at the beginning of 2018, the bulk of the stock buybacks happened in the second half of the year. A few reasons for that. Kimberly Clausing, who teaches economics at Reed College, says companies probably took time to think over their options, maybe pay down some debt, and then?
I suspect that they just sort of ran out of things to do with it, and so they started handing more of it back to the shareholders.
Also, if a company wants to buy back its stock, it can't always do that immediately. Mark Mazur again.
For some firms, they have to ask for stockholder permission to increase the amount that they're going to buy back.
Or maybe companies were afraid of the political fallout of doing buybacks right after a tax cut. Another takeaway from the Moody's report is that this buyback frenzy might not be sustainable. Remember, stock buybacks are a way to give money back to shareholders. If a company buys its own shares, there will be fewer on the market and each one will be worth more. Christina Padgett is a senior vice president at Moody's.
The concern is that as the market may turn, the shareholder doesn't expect those share repurchases to go away.
And she says companies might feel torn between holding on to their cash and making shareholders happy. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I want to see people like figure out a way to be with each other and whether they should be with each other.
A plea for more rom-coms. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials off 122 points today, 0.4%, 26,307. The NASDAQ shed 12 points, about a 0.1%, 8,036. The S&P 500 down 0.6%, 29 and 17. Dow DuPont dropped 6 and a 10% today. The chemicals company posted a 24% drop in first quarter core earnings, which is basically what everybody thought was going to happen, by the way. Under Armour leapt up 3.5%. The sportswear firm posted earnings and sales that topped expectations. Energy companies faltered a bit as record crude production in this country pushed down oil prices. ExxonMobil down about 1.7%. Valero shed 1.6% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.54%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, I'm Molly Wood. On the Marketplace Tech Podcast, we give you a daily smart take on the digital economy, from cybersecurity around local elections to how your television might give you personalized ads. We help you better understand the tech that impacts your life and your work. Join me every weekday for Marketplace Tech. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As we mentioned yesterday, the latest round of Sino-American trade talks is happening in Beijing this week, Washington next. As happens in negotiations this complicated, the really tricky stuff has been left till the end: forced technology transfers and intellectual property theft, to be specific. But you know what affects way more American companies in China than those two things? Something called trademark squatting. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack sat down with some intellectual property experts and sent us this report from Shanghai.
Top 10 fashion brands.
Sure.
2018.
Joe Simone is an intellectual property specialist. He says if you look up the trendiest fashion brands, first one on the list comes from the UK, chances are the trademark is already registered in China by someone else.
We have one, two, three different companies that have filed for it. The first one, it was a company in Jinhua City in Zhejiang Province.
The UK brand owner has not filed for a Chinese trademark. It means if the UK label sells its clothing in Shanghai's shopping malls, it can be sued for infringing on trademark holders, who all appear to be Chinese nationals.
Well, these guys almost certainly aren't using the mark. They're sitting around waiting to be bought out.
He calls these trademark filers pirates, and they exist because, unlike the U.S., where trademark rights are granted to the one who uses the mark first, in China, it's given to who registers the mark first. Last year, Simone surveyed 500 American fashion designers, and half of them said they had been victims of trademark squatting. Some brand owners, like basketball star Michael Jordan, try to fight back. Chinese news outlets hailed his trademark victory in 2016. That's when China's Supreme Court ruled that Jordan has a right to the Chinese rendering of his name, Qiao Dan. It took him years to win and didn't prevent the multi-million dollar sportswear company Qiao Dan from using a logo similar to Jordan's Nike brand. Plus, there are high legal fees for these court cases, says Simone.
Which is why sometimes companies say, I'll pay $50,000, I'll pay $100,000, sometimes, you know, up to $500,000 when, you know, to settle with these sort of pirates.
Even if you don't plan on selling to Chinese consumers, you should guard your trademark, says lawyer Dan Harris. He advises companies that do business in China.
We were contacted by four European companies that controlled maybe around 80% of a particular product market.
Those firms all produced in China but didn't file for trademarks. So one of their Chinese manufacturers registered all four European brands.
Then once they actually got their China trademark, they told these four companies, you cannot ship product from China anymore. It was a disaster for these four companies.
Trademark squatting is not unique to China, but there are so many people filing, says Diane Reed with Kenobi Martins in California.
We still continue to bring new actions against different entities trying to cleverly register a mark that's very similar.
But a few days before the new round of U.S.-China trade talks, intellectual property specialist Joe Simone told me of a significant change in Chinese trademark law.
China decided to impose fines on trademark pirates. Now, on top of that, the trademark agent or lawyer who assisted the applicant, the pirate, may also be fined.
He says this can help deter trademark squatting, but the best defense, he says, is to register your trademark in China right away. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Hollywood right now. That is, the slice of the American movie business that's driven by the big studios is the reserve of the tentpole, Avengers Endgame being Exhibit A. And I'm a fan. It was too long, but I'm a fan. But there is another kind of film that's been getting less common the past decade or so. After a long run as a Hollywood go-to, the classic romantic comedy, Sleepless in Seattle, When Harry Met Sally, not that they were all Meg Ryan films. But anyway, Wesley Morris, critic-at-large for the New York Times, wrote about this very topic in a piece called Rom-Coms Were Corny and Retrograde, Why Do I Miss Them So Much? Wesley, it's good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you, Kai. What's happening?
No, man. We're just, you know, we're talking about this article. And I have to tell you, we have come to refer to it around here as Wesley's Lament
for the rom-com.
That feels right to me.
Now, why? What's going on? Why do you miss them, and where did they go?
Okay. Well, why I miss them because it's the only movie genre that I can think of that is really, truly interested in and dedicated to how people get along, right? The plan that it sets out for its two main characters, it's typically two, is to have these two personalities find a way to think about and consider by the end of the movie having a life together. You know, we're talking about a genre that is predominantly white and heterosexual.
Right.
But
we'll
setting
get to
aside,
that in a minute. Yeah.
Right. But setting aside the sort of the optics and you know, questions of representation, I think that the philosophy of the genre was, hey, here's a man and here's a woman. What would it take to get these two people to realize that they love each other?
Okay. So, yes to all of that. I have a couple of questions. One is, have they really gone away, or have they just changed form? I mean, you talk about Crazy Rich Asians, which I would have called a rom-com. You, however, call it a fizzy soap opera.
It just, there's too many other things happening in that movie. If it had just, I do, because I've been listening to people for half a year call this movie a romantic comedy, and it's not. It has romantic comedy elements in it, but there's like three other subplots, they're not even subplots, they're adjacent plots.
Can we safely call you a rom-com purist? Is that what
I
that
am? Okay. Yes, I'm 100% that, so you have to deal with that
no,
too.
Fair enough. Look, we called you, man. I will take what you're giving. Another issue, and this is just about the kinds of movies Hollywood is making, and also, oh, by the way, where the money is. There's a film coming out this week. I think it's this weekend, right? Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen.
Yes.
It's
Long Shot.
It's politics and this and that. I would, once again, I'm not a purist. I would call that a rom-com. But you juxtapose that, and I don't know how much money it's going to make, but you juxtapose that with Endgame, which is rapidly approaching like 10 figures in worldwide box office. Of course, they're going to make more Avengers and fewer mid-budget rom-coms, right?
Yes. I think that I don't think the superhero movie's lucrativeness should disincentivize the studios against making more movies like Long Shot. But, you know, you can see a movie like Long Shot and see the ways that the market has made what, I mean, it is a romantic comedy, Long Shot, but there are also, because it's closer to the Seth Rogen end of romantic comedy.
Right, right. Which is a certain genre of romantic comedy, right?
Right. It has to do all these other things. But, you know, once the gears of that movie sort of like kick in, it does work. There's a way that Seth Rogen looks at Charlize Theron in this movie, and I've never seen a man look at a woman so adoringly in the movies. I don't think maybe ever.
All right.
That's
fair. But I'm gonna riff on that line, actually, and I'm gonna quote you back to yourself. And we were talking about how they are white and heterosexual and not generally representative of society at large. You say in this piece that you wrote, I'm a single black gay man and therefore an unlikely champion of the American romantic comedy. What's in these movies for you? What is in these movies for you, and do we need to keep making them?
I'm a human being, damn it. And as a human being, I really do want to see people make it. And I don't mean like physically make it, although that's appealing too. I want to see people like figure out a way to be with each other and whether they should be with each other. And a good romantic comedy, even a mediocre one, tries to do that work. Of course they could stand to be browner and gayer and, you know, everything else, right? But the fundamental beauty of these movies as a genre is that they were fundamentally interested in people and the relationships that we have with each other. And everybody at some point in their life has tried to look for somebody to date or marry or something. It's such a universal experience. And these movies, I have never freed hostages from, you know, an Eastern European bad guy. I've never done that before, but I have been on some dates and I've tried to be in relationships before.
Wesley Morris, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, a critic at large for the paper as well, writes on a bunch of stuff, and he is always great to talk to. Wesley, we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, which is a little bit grim, yes, but which is also kind of a good indicator of one of the dilemmas of this digital age. Researchers at Oxford University over in the UK crunched some numbers, as it were, and came up with this. If Facebook keeps growing the way it has been, at least 4.9 billion Facebook users will die by the end of this century. Now, yes, in the long run, we are all dead, but that is a whole lot of digital life out there that is going to be left behind. All right, we're going. The Dow Industrial is off 122 points today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ gave back 12 points, about a 0.1%. S&P 500 lost 6 points, 0.2%. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bekela, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.